Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, your one-stop shop for two-party cope, brought to you by the magazine of Free Minds and Free Markets and Clucking Nick Gillespie's in the background. I am Matt Welch, joined by the aforementioned Clucking Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Kathleen Mankey Ward. Happy snow day, everyone.
Howdy.
Hello, Matt.
Happy Tuesday.
That's right. We're going to get into last night's Iowa caucuses. Do we call it, caucuses, even though it's one party, right?
Cocci.
Well, there are multiple. They gathered all over in the multiple caucuses, I think.
Anyways, we're going to do all that here in a moment. But first.
Hey, folks, this is Spike Cohen, and I'm inviting you to join me next year in Washington, D.C. for LibertyCon. This flagship event by Students for Liberty is being hosted in D.C. the weekend of February the 2nd through the 4th at the Grand Hyatt. Join me and speakers and students from over 30 different countries in one place as we discuss the libertarian solutions that will shape our world and lead us to a freer future. We're going to feature panels, discussions, debates, and breakout sessions with featured guests like former Congressman Justin Amash, Tuttle Twins author Connor Boyack, Whole Foods founder John Mackey, economist Deidre McCloskey and Brian Kaplan, independent journalist Ford Fisher, and many more incredible people. You'll hear from organizations such as Fee, Reason Magazine, and my organization, You Are the Power. We've even got a special secret guest speaker. Who is it? Well, there's only one way to find out. Join me at LibertyCon. Register right now at libertycon.com and be sure to use the promo code ROUNDTABLE to save 25% off your registration. And I'll see you at LibertyCon.
Okay, in the immortal words of Reason Roundup, editrix Liz Wolf, last night it all became a lot more real. I don't know why she has Batman's voice, but why not? Former President Donald J. Trump put the front in frontrunner in the first in the nation Iowa caucuses, winning 51% of the vote for Republican presidential nomination, including 98 of 99 counties. And that one holdout was wee little Johnson County went to Nikki Haley by one vote. That is why Catherine, by the way, make sure to vote in every election. If anything, the results for Trump, who, let us not forget, is leading in national primary polls by nearly 50 percentage points, were even better than that sounds. Ron DeSantis, Meatball Ron, with his second place, 21%, which somewhat exceeded the expectations. And Nikki Haley, with her third place, 19%, were close enough to each other that they each punched their ticket into New Hampshire and probably beyond, thus cleaving the non-Trump field in two. And the fourth place finisher, Vivek Ramaswamy, with 8%, promptly dropped out and endorsed Trump. Likely ensuring that everyone who enjoys the phrase J6 hostages will consolidate under one candidate. So we seem to be a good deal closer than we were last week to the inevitable Trump-Biden matchup that literally no one in America wants. Or as Rachel Maddow would say last night, apparently on the MSNBC channel, our democracy is falling to an authoritarian and potentially fascist form of government. 11 months of this, people. Speaking of...
She's on a four-year time delay, so that was actually from 2020.
Catherine, on the one hand, the Iowa caucuses did not, in fact, predict the future GOP nominations of Ted Cruz or Rick Santorum or Mike Huckabee. On the other hand, Trump obliterated the competition by a margin never really before seen by a non-incumbent. And then on the third hand, your gal pal Nikki Haley has halved Trump's lead in New Hampshire over the past month in the run-up to next week's primary. Where is your Trump inevitability needle right now, Catherine? And how does your robot libertarian heart feel about it?
I deeply resent the phrase Trump inevitability needle and would like you to never use it again, please. But the New York Times was doing
I'm waiting for you to crochet me a sweater with your Trump inevitability.
Wow, that's sexist. You're walking right up to the make me a sandwich line. And I finally watched the Barbie.
It's just really cold.
I watched the Barbie movie this weekend. I don't know why it took me this long to watch it. And I do want to note vis-a-vis both make me a sweater and the fascist line. The best line in that movie is when the girl calls Barbie a fascist, and Barbie she's crying and she says she thinks I'm a fascist. I don't control the railways or the flow of commerce. It's a good movie, guys, is what I'm saying. Anyway.
Yeah, we saw
it. I know everyone else saw it when it came out. I recognize I am comically, horrifically late.
And when she dropped the atomic bomb on the Japanese, it was the event of the summer.
All of this is by way of saying I don't want to talk about Donald Trump, but I guess we have to. We're back to the place that we have been really for years and years now, which is that the country is split more or less 50-50 Republican Democrat. And it looks like what that will mean is that it's going to be 50-50 Biden or Trump. And that's what it usually is. And that's a terrible choice. You are quite right that no one in America wants that, least of all.
Make a correction of our humble leader, our humble yet fearless leader? The country is split 27%, according to new Gallup political affiliation data, Matt Welch, and you know where this is going. But the Democratic Party is at a low of 27% of people saying they affiliate as Democrats. 27% of people identify as Republicans. The rest are independents. So it will end up being 50-50 in the presidential race. But in fact, the number of people who are behind these two paper mache Mephistopheli is shrinking.
You should write a book about that.
You know?
Yeah. Nick, so that ties an all-time high, that 43% of self-identified independents.
That's right. And this time we mean it, Matt Welch.
And yet it stubbornly does not translate. When you look around right now.
What do you mean it doesn't translate?
Into presidential politics and voting. Or voting in presidential politics, if you prefer.
No, well, there's only two parties that are on the ballot everywhere.
They're really? There will be the Libertarian Party will be in 40-something probably ballots, I would guess. Yeah. The Green Party might match its last election number of 30 state ballots. And Jill Stein's back in it, people. So that's exciting.
Is that true?
Oh man, I've been mentally filtering her name. Like I created like a,
what kind of doctor is she? Is she like a dentist or?
I used to know that information. I'm getting slow.
I think
in
she's like an internist. She's an MD, right?
She's not like Dr. Jill Biden
or
physician.
Dr. Nick Gillespie.
We know
we'll get
this.
TV's Andy Levy to tell us that in
she
the
gets
halftime.
Co-payments. Just to follow up a little bit. Then,
let me finish my point. No labels will probably shush. No labels will probably get on 30 ballots. RFK Jr., who is polling at 15%. We haven't seen an independent poll this high or a third party candidate poll this high. Shut up. In 30 years. So, Nick, I want you to weigh the positive, like seemingly positive sort of conditions for a third party candidate with the kind of seemingly inevitable needle of negative polarization. Do you have optimism for third party ish stuff given that that kind of positive vibes coming out right now?
Yeah. So in 2020, only 2% of voters voted for a third party candidate. In 2016, 6% did. Including our glorious two-term governor, toe-missing, frostbitten Mount Everest climber Gary Johnson.
We've seen that.
Doing it pretty substantially. I think this is the real wild card in this election because Kennedy is an awful candidate. He is basically an insane conspiracy theorist, as we have well documented at Reason. I don't necessarily hold that against him, but I think he's going to have a pretty big impact or could conceivably have a big impact. But the main you asked, Matt, why doesn't this translate into presidential whatever? It's like because we have two parties that dominate. I suspect I prophesy. I'm putting on the hat of Tiresias. This is the last election where the Republican and Democratic parties, as we know them, run candidates. By 2028, there will be a major realignment. It's not necessarily going to be better for libertarians, but like, this is it. Like, you cannot, Donald Trump is not a Republican in any meaningful way, other than that he commands about 95% of people who call themselves Republican. But he is not free trade. He is not, you know, he's not for open borders or any kind of immigration. He is something different. And I think we'll see a major realignment after this. But in the meantime, you know, it's like, hold on to your seats.
Would point out that RFK, also according to Gallup polling from last week, has by far the most positive vibes coming from the electorate. His net favorability rating is actually favorable, unlike those of Trump, Biden, Nikki Haley, and
very Pete quickly, well, you know, the specter looming over all of this, I don't think it has to do with Donald Trump as much as it has to do with Joe Biden, who, and this is something in the media, and if you live in DC or New York, it is hard to remember all the time. Joe Biden is less popular than Donald Trump was at this point in Trump's presidency. Joe Biden is a complete, well, according to Real Clear Politics, they're average. His approval rating is lower than Trump's was at like week 150 or whatever we're at. Biden is making all of this possible because he is a massively unpopular figure in American politics and does not have, you know, he is not generating any heat or warmth out of Democrats.
There was a good piece by Jack Schaefer on that point about 8 days ago that I commend people to read. Peter, we get to allow you to talk now. You're from Florida. We know because you've been very articulate and also clean over the past several months talking about your personal and substantive policy disagreements with Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, but let's put on your I'm a normal person hat for a second here. How, even though he did slightly better than we expected in this caucuses, man, 12 months ago, he was polling within 15 percentage points of Donald Trump. He looked like the guy who could challenge him. He's had a really, really bad 12 months. What is your analysis for why his campaign has performed so poorly so far?
So the first thing I want to say is that instead of the Ron DeSantis campaign, we should have had another Marvel movie. Because as much as I have stopped enjoying Marvel movies, they cost about $200 million. And that is what Ron DeSantis has spent to make his poll numbers drop massively over the course of the last year. And I would have just rather had Black Widow 2, as much as I thought the first one was kind of mediocre.
I liked it. Yeah, it was all right.
So Ron DeSantis did not run a particularly good campaign in a bunch of ways. I think his campaign resembles two different candidates, one Republican and one Democrat, who failed to become the
Kree
presidential
nominee. Kree and Skrull, maybe?
Yes, exactly. No, Elizabeth Warren and Scott Walker, both of whom were party elite favorites, who were planners, more specifically in Elizabeth Warren's case, she ran on, I got a plan for that. But Scott Walker, when he entered the race, was a guy who was a governor who had done a bunch of stuff. And a lot of stuff, even that folks here on this podcast thought was, hey, that was pretty good. You were a pretty good governor. You showed that you could do the executive, like that you could both do the politics side, but also do the policymaking side of running a state administration. And Ron DeSantis looked like that coming into the race. And then what did Ron DeSantis do? Well, the first thing he did was he mostly declined, especially at first, to run on his actual record. And so the stuff that he did as governor of Florida was that made him most popular was his COVID stuff. And partly he mostly didn't talk about that. Instead, he talked about all of his culture war stuff, all of his free speech stuff, all of his sort of extremely online stuff. It's easy to forget, even here on this very online panel. But Ron DeSantis entered the race by going on a live stream with Elon Musk on what was then Twitter. And we all had to wait like a full hour for them to get the technology right, even though Twitter has been around for, 15 years or whatever. And it was like that was Ron DeSantis's idea of let's do a cool big splash campaign entry is we're going to have a conversation with Elon Musk on Twitter. And then the rest of the campaign, especially the first 6 or 8 months of it, really looked a lot like just more of that. Like that was the big idea. idea that drove it. We're going to be very online and appeal to a narrow group of people who spend all of their time on Twitter, which is not what the Republican voting base, even the relatively small group that is the primary voters, that's not what they look like. They are not extremely online. And this is one of the things we found out. One of the things that last night really, really confirmed, which is that the Republican voting base, and particularly the Republican voting base that votes for Trump, is older, more rural, less college educated, and quite willing to believe that Biden did not legitimately win the 2020 election, that actually Trump was robbed. And that was not who DeSantis was playing to. He was playing to a bunch of like kind of industrial policy, new nationalist, super online types that are not actually that big a constituency, because even though those people kind of like Trump and what they view Trump as a vehicle for pursuing a very particular agenda. And so I think, you know, Ron DeSantis just didn't run a very good campaign. But the other thing here is, even if Ron DeSantis had run the very best possible campaign, it's not obvious to me at this point that he could have won the nomination. Maybe he could have gotten closer, but I am, after watching last night, yes, Iowa is a little bit different than other states, but after watching last night, I'm fairly convinced, maybe not totally, but fairly convinced that there was just no path for any candidate not named Donald Trump to win the GOP nomination this year.
Man, a lot of past tense there, Peter Suderman.
Hey, Matt, as I believe you were the biographer of a certain maverick named John McCain, what does his unlikely ascent to the Republican nomination in 2008, a year that didn't really exist, but we pretend as if it did, what does that tell us about any of the relevance of what we're talking about right now?
The Nikki Haley path is the John McCain path, which is to say her only chance of winning, which I think right now have been reduced to nearly zero with the results from last night, because what she needed was a big second place victory over Ron DeSantis so that he would drop out, so that she could have a one-on-one fight against Trump in New Hampshire, which she would probably win if it was just the two of them, I think. New Hampshire allows a lot of party switching, a lot of independents to vote, unlike Iowa, although there was some attempt by some Democrats to switch parties at the last minute, involve themselves in the caucuses. So John McCain won the 2008 nomination in a field that was more crowded and contentious than this field is, and without this you know, huge ex-president in the middle of it. He won that by getting non-Republican votes. All of his early state victories relied on people who self-identified as Democrats or as independents, like actual independents. They don't belong to a party. And also anti-war people. So he won New Hampshire, and he won some other early states that are described that way. And then everyone else sort of fell off. It was totally weird, unusual. That's her only hope, I think. And it has dwindled a lot. So you know, she is pretty clearly the choice of the media, of a certain kind of donor class, a certain kind of establishment. The poll numbers that Peter was alluding to about the number of people who thought Biden was stolen, or Biden stole the 2020 election, it's remarkable to see the split in who those people voted for versus those who thought it was not stolen voted for. They all voted for Nikki Haley. It was those who thought it was stolen. None of them voted for Nikki Haley. It's amazing. So that's the path, but the path doesn't really. It's such a long shot at this point, is what I think. Catherine, I wanted to ask you about the media, since you edited a magazine, from what I understand. Last night, there was a lot of chatter, including by the DeSantis people, but also a lot of journalists, that, gosh, it was odd that the entire media called the election for Donald Trump before they stopped voting. Did you also find that odd, or are you shrugging and mad because elections?
I mean, the thing that I read this morning from the AP, which was a very aggressive, like, there is nothing to see here explanation of why they called the election so early in Iowa, actually in the end was fairly convincing. They basically said, listen, we have these rules. The rules apply to normal primary voting. Iowa is bananas. And that's just true, right? Like the caucuses are a super, super weird phenomenon. Like people are in somebody's living room. They're writing on a little piece of paper. They're putting it in like a grocery bag. Like we
literally watched on CNN as some of the votes were pulled out of giant movie theater popcorn tubs.
This is what's going on, right? Ooh. And so when we're like, obviously we have this national preoccupation right now with election security. And, you know, rightly so in some cases, like our elections are not conducted to the highest level imaginable. But the caucuses are by design just like this like scrappy, bonkers kind of irregular thing. And what AP said and what other outlets said is like, there's no moment where like the polls close and the exit polls are in and you can call the state in the way that you can in other places. And I buy that. And frankly, like they called it early, but they called it right. Trump won by a lot, it seems. And so, I do think part of the preoccupation with this early call is the ongoing, I think, misguided preoccupation with the second place race. And like we are guilty of this too at Reason. Like, okay, who's in the debate? It's Nikki Haley and Ron DeSantis. So I guess we'll cover it because what we do is cover debates. Like, who is competitive in a result in the caucuses? It's Nikki Haley and Ron DeSantis. So we want to wait and cover it because that's what we cover. But Donald Trump has broken all of these things. He's not participating in the normal stuff and people still like him and he really did win. So I think the obsession with the early call is very much a like insider media thing and that it didn't influence anything in the end.
They could have been pulling actual popcorn out of those popcorn bins while watching Black Widow 2 if Ron DeSantis hadn't run.
Use that freestyle soda machine too. Maybe Stubbs members, Peter, at the theater get two votes or something. Who is the worst? What's the worst outcome for libertarians? So Trump, Haley, DeSantis, Biden? I mean, I think Biden is the worst outcome as president, but
I
think it's a real, arguably Haley and DeSantis are far worse for libertarians than Trump.
I mean, Nick, as someone who supported, I think, both impeachments of Donald Trump, it seems odd that you would think that Biden is a worse outcome than Trump. I think Trump's behavior on January up to and including on January 6, 2021 is a disqualification.
I agree with that.
I put him in a category of worse for me, but I don't speak for libertarians, certainly.
And with Biden, I noted in a pre-election video, whatever it was, 2020, that there were 11 trillion reasons to be really worried about Joe Biden, which had to do with his promised increases in spending, which he's doing pretty good on committing.
Peter, you were interjecting.
Yeah, just a quick note that it's worth remembering that when Donald Trump didn't win the Iowa primary, his reaction was to say, the Iowa caucus, cockeye. Yes, the bird squeaking noise. His reaction all those years ago was to say, actually, this is rigged and I did win. And that was, it turned out to be a preview of his reaction to losing a presidential election in 2020. And so that establishes a pattern. It's not 2020 was not a one-off. And that's why I think there are certainly very big and important ways in which Donald Trump is obviously worse than any of the other candidates. Because if you want a functioning government, if you want to, you can't get to the policy level of things until you have a basically functional democracy that says we accept when we lose and violence is not an appropriate reaction to that. And Donald Trump failed that test.
I agree. But it's not just Donald Trump. It's the whole ecosystem that gets put into place. It's not clear to me that America under Joe Biden and the Congress that got elected, et cetera, is radically different or worse than it was under Trump. And I think a Trump 2.0, if this is what we're reduced to, is Biden second term, Trump second term, I suspect that the kind of shock to the system will be ultimately be more beneficial if it's Trump as president.
I think it's really reasonable for libertarians to do what several of the libertarians that I know in Iowa did, which is none of the above. Iowa caucuses let you do a none of the above vote. And that is something that, frankly, I would love to see on the national level. I would go vote just to be able to vote none of the above, actually. So there's a loophole in my non-voting principle. And
move to Nevada.
I think to ask questions like, well, which one is better or worse for libertarians is to miss an opportunity to also just say none of the above, like not this system, not these candidates, none of this. And of course, in the end, we will have one of the above and we can talk about that. But,
yeah.
You know, when Peter was mentioning about Trump contesting the original Iowa caucus vote, it reminded me, I have like a rule that I try to follow in hiring, which is when you do a job interview, and arguably the Iowa caucuses are like somehow a job interview for president. The little thing that bothers you in the job interview, when you say like, oh, this seemed like a really good candidate, but it was weird when they did X. Like, it was weird that they rescheduled twice. It was weird that they talked a little too long. It was weird that they said this thing. That's the thing that will be the biggest problem with that person as a colleague and an employee later on. Like, you have to listen to the little voice that's like, that was weird. Because I think if America had listened to the little voice that was like, what do you mean you won the Iowa caucuses, my dude? No, you didn't. We could be in a very different place right now.
Can we call that the that was weird rule?
Yeah, the that was weird. I think I really genuinely think it works for candidates. You're like, this candidate could be an okay president, but it's weird how they X. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing. That's the war they start. That's the disastrous new cabinet level department. That's the, obviously the stakes are much higher in this case than when you hire like an assistant editor at Reason.
So speaking of that, Nick, we don't have either Vivek Ramaswamy or Chris Christie to kick around anymore, at least in the Republican primaries, because the Libertarian Party has been sniffing around Vivek, and No Labels is trying to butter up the former New Jersey governor. Which is a nice mental image.
That makes sense. That makes sense.
Would you like to deliver eulogies for either one of their GOP campaigns?
No.
Okay.
I don't care.
We come not to bury them, but to praise them.
No, we come to bury them. Right. In an unmarked grave.
So let's finish off this segment. Peter, we saw a slew of endorsements in the run-up before even the Iowa caucuses. Including former very strong-throated Trump critics Marco Rubio, Little Marco, and Mike Lee coming out for Trump, with Lee saying that Trump delivered on promises and that's more important than mean tweets. Rand Paul, after a bit of a tease, came out with a Never Nikki campaign. Might also be pointed out here that he wasn't talking about Darling Nikki either. It was also pointed out that the also libertarian-leaning Republican Thomas Massie in the House long ago came out for Ron DeSantis, his former colleague. What is your opinion, Peter Suderman, slash assessment of the endorsement game in the GOP, and particularly what it says about the more libertarian-ish corners of the Republican caucus?
It doesn't matter very much. The endorsements aren't driving votes toward Donald Trump. Donald Trump was going to be the winner regardless of who endorsed him. It tells us a little bit about the ways that the libertarian-leaning camp, and that's definitely not the libertarian camp because I don't think there is a libertarian camp, but the ways in which the libertarian-leaning camp, the thing that they prioritize, in some ways, understandably, is foreign policy, I think. And Nikki Haley is, from a libertarian perspective, the least libertarian, the worst on foreign policy, the one who is most aggressive internationally and has positioned herself that way and is most likely to. Her little thing is, you know what? Maybe she's going to start like three more wars, not even ones that we can plan on right now. And that's actually kind of a big deal, as we talked about last week, because the president has more direct control over foreign policy than over domestic economic policy. And I find Nikki Haley's general normalness as a politician, her sense of competence and not being like just a bizarre person, I find that in some ways appealing. I also think that she is a reasonably good communicator and, like, again, just seems like somebody who you could talk to and sort of work with in some ways, and that is appealing. But as a foreign policy thinker, or sort of policymaker, she's awful. She is not someone who I would want you know, in the Oval Office. And so I think it's totally fair for those endorsements to be anti-Nikki. But no, the endorsements don't matter very much. This was Donald Trump's race. He won it because he was, because there wasn't really, there wasn't a real race here. This was a race to see if there was a race. And what we found out was, nope, this is Donald Trump is the incumbent in the Republican Party, and everybody's treating him that way. He's treating himself that way. And nobody has managed to make a convincing argument to the contrary. I mean, it tells you something that Nikki Haley has basically said, you know what, if Donald Trump's the nominee, I'm probably going to support it.
I do want to note Rand Paul did two things at the end of last week. One was his like tease and then delivery of the Never Nikki campaign. The other was write an article for Reason.com that was pretty good that had nothing to do with anything.
Yeah, it was very good.
Why America should be more like Sweden. It's not what you think. And it was it was like a real study. And to me, not only like it was a good piece, but also the duality of the libertarian-ish person in Congress, like what that actually looks like. And it's just like so often being forced to participate in the garbage that is actual electoral politics and politicking. And then also, by the way, like here, like the policy is good. We have some good policy to offer you here from Rand Paul. And I wish that the people who hold power in this country could spend more time on the latter and less on the former.
I think he's going to release a libertarian leaning Republican celebrity version of Imagine this week, Matt, just to keep himself in the press.
I don't think so.
That would be pretty great, though, right? Can we do that with AI yet?
No.
We can. We absolutely can. Are you kidding me?
We absolutely can. There's
I mean, I think I could have it done like, by the end of this
for podcast. For sure. Yeah. That's the kicker music on this podcast. Yeah, totally. Ian, please make it happen.
I would prefer not to. Bartleby the Scrivener.
There's a fantastic AI thing that Stephen Hyden, the great rock critic, pointed to last week of Elvis introducing his band, like Vegas Elvis, and like Stevie Wonder's on keys and Jimmy Page is on guitar. And for some reason, Sheryl Crow is on bass. Why not?
That was kind of like the AI equivalent of having like six fingers or something like that. You know, it's strange. As long as we're talking about AI bands and really on politics is a nightmare. Google that image of a guy who said, I asked AI to create an image of the Beatles having tea in nature.
No.
And there are five Beatles. All of like, I've been in many conversations where people are like, which is the false Beatle in this? It's very funny.
People,
many conversations.
There's like jackalopes in
people
the
verbally describing AI images has exactly the same vibe as people describing a dream that they had. Like it's not.
Or a drug experience. Which
or a
is
drug
not
experience.
Unrelated in this particular case.
Yeah.
All right. We're going to get to our listener email of the week here in a moment. But first, the world would be a better, freer, and happier place if constitutional protections for private property were taken just a tad or even two or three tads more seriously. So saith our good friends over at the Institute for Justice. Yes. We've just released a new season of their legal history podcast, Bound by Oath. Bound by Oath tells the story of how the Supreme Court has cleared the way for government officials to abuse property rights, to trespass on private land without a warrant, to restrict peaceful and productive uses of property, to seize and keep property without sufficient justification, and much more. Featuring interviews not only with scholars and litigators, but also with the real-life people behind some of the Supreme Court's most momentous property rights decisions. The new season explores the history behind today's civil rights battles, so plug Bound by Oath into wherever you get your podcast. Please start with episode one. Order is very important. That's Bound by Oath, Institute for Justice, Property Rights. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. All right, reminder, email your terse queries to roundtable@reason.com. This one comes from Ben Stein, who even describes himself as the one and only, though I have my doubts about that. Bueller. He writes, I was listening to the latest episode of Just Asking Question. Editor's note here, that's the great weekly Liz Wolf, Zach Weissmuller joint where I myself might be joining this week. Back to Ben. When the guest mentioned that car seat laws can discourage people from having kids, the roundtable is often critical of giving people money to make babies But are there any bad laws out there discouraging reproduction that we could get rid of? Catherine, you made babies. What say you?
Yes. Reason actually covered this car seat thing in 2020. So this study has been lurking around for a while. And yeah, there was a study that suggested that the comically, insanely long period for which we now require not just car seats, but like big, bulky car seats and also kids facing backward up to age two. Might on the margins, there might be some evidence that women either postpone or decide not to have a third child, literally just because they can't fit them all in the damn car. And as someone who has, you know, installed two car seats in the backseat of a car and did so for many years, I fully believe this study. I absolutely would do anything.
During that drunken hookup with your future husband, you were like, oh my God. That's fucking car seats.
I would do anything to not install three car seats in a car ever, including like getting my tubes tied. So I think that this makes sense. There are a whole bunch of other things, of course, that we could do that would make it easier to have kids, including DC has a requirement now that like daycare workers have to have a bachelor's degree or an associate's degree at least or something, which is insane. That dramatically raises the cost of childcare. However, actually, it seems like the number of kids that people have is not terribly subject to any legal intervention. You can't bribe people, but also just the cost kind of generically, which could be increased by regulations and that kind of thing, seems to matter so much less than general societal wealth overall and women's education levels. So I actually think it's probably a cool and good thing that there's almost nothing the government could do to affect people's decisions on this, except maybe get the hell out of the way of general prosperity, in which case we would probably end up with fewer babies, not more.
Matt, I want to point out that our coverage of this study is junk science. It really is bullshit. And I think our coverage of it pointed heavily towards that. But and Catherine is absolutely right. But if we want to make it easier for people to have kids, I want to suggest repealing child labor laws, because then kids would be two tiny little hands to work, not one more mouth to feed.
Oh my God.
And if that argument is true about immigration, and I think it is, it must axiomatically be true about children.
Nick just wants nicer carpets, and we need the tiny yeah, fingers to work the looms to
there
tie the knots.
You know, in so many electrical outlets and things like that, like, you know, an adult hand can't get in there, but a kid's
crawl space. It's called a crawl space for a reason. Yeah. Yep.
Those soccer That's balls right. are not going to sew themselves. Peter, can you make this all about zoning, please?
No, I just don't think there's very much the government can do. This was the conclusion of Elizabeth Nolan Brown's really excellent cover story from last year. Storks don't take orders from the state. I wish I could take even a small amount of credit for that headline, but I cannot take any. It's excellent.
That was also the
Catherine
first
thought that one up.
Two different covers within a span of months in which like a bird is in mortal peril. Like, I don't know what happened with us, but we have.
Do you,
what was
do
the
you
other
know,
one?
Joanna?
The other one was the Endangered Species Act at 50, which had the golden warbler with an arrow through its throat.
Right. Yeah.
But they were all part of the genus cockeye.
Yeah.
No.
Cockeye. It didn't. So my answer to this question, while accepting all the previous answers with the possible exception of Nick's, is that, and I think about this a lot, I don't know if I care for policymakers to be obsessing about birth rates, but I do care about people in positions of power and lawmakers making places more friendly for families and what that difference looks like. And the main thing that you can do, and this is a big difference from the California I grew up in and the California now, is that you can allow for a place to be much cheaper to live. It's amazing to me how much California has gotten old and less filled with kids. I grew up on a block with, and I know I'm sounding like an old fusty person. Yes, but I grew up on a block where there was just like probably 75 kids on a residential block between 0 and 17, just running amok. It was fantastic. You go to the same block now, you go to the big parks that are in that area, and with the exception of soccer day, it is just, there's not that many people out there, but partly because it's really an unfriendly place to live for families. California, I mean, or anywhere within like 30 miles of the coast in California, it's just way too expensive. So if you make building and land use just onerous in every kind of sense of development of it, and you price people out, they're going to leave. They're leaving New York City in droves right now, especially if you have families, if your education system sucks, K through 12 education as provided by the government sucks, the families are going to run away. If it becomes a lot more unsafe to live in certain places, they're going to run away. Texas is a lot cheaper to live in. There's many reasons not to live in Texas, I understand, from some points of view. But the basic of like, I can buy a house for X amount and live here for X amount, if that's cheaper, that's more friendly to families. And you can really see the difference in places where there's a lot more of a younger population as opposed to an older one. It just feels more vibrant and interesting than what a lot of these sort of aging left of center places live in. And that's the end of my rant. All right. So last week, we don't have a
change your diaper, Matt, and let's get on with the next segment.
Thank you.
Old man.
Last week, the United States and a small coalition, including the United Kingdom, began bombing separatist Houthis in the part of Yemen they control in retaliation for the Iranian-backed group continuing to fire rockets and missiles and pull off the odd hijackings of commercial ships attempting to travel through the Red Sea. The Biden administration bragged that Iran had gotten the message not to escalate, which was then followed by Iran sending deadly missile fire into northern Iraq. Meanwhile, Axios is reporting that Biden is, quote, running out of patience, unquote, with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his prosecution of the war in Gaza, though what that patience run outery will translate into is anybody's guess. And, oh yeah, the British Defense Secretary warned in a recent speech that we could be entering within 5 years World War III. So, Catherine, let's start with the narrow question. Is the bombing of Houthi infrastructure legal under the War Powers Act, as Ilya Soman pretty much argued in the Volokh Conspiracy, hosted by Reason? Or is it illegal, as is maintained by your former podcast friend, Justin Amash?
That was incredible ways to introduce those people. I would love for Congress generally to just have more say about when we fire weapons at people. But I have been following the Houthi conflict purely through the question of how many mentions I'm seeing of the Barbary pirates. Like, that's, you know, that's 100%. I'm like, is this how serious is this? Like, oh, I saw three articles about the Barbary pirates today. That feels like it's heating up. Because there isn't a kind of very, very relevant and interesting precedent on this question of pirates who are like, you know, harshing our buzz, man. So, yeah, I think I'm just going to fall on the side of it's good to make the Amashian argument that Congress should just have a say. Congress should have a say, because we are so far out of whack in the other direction right now that I am kind of not willing to negotiate on the margins. But I did find Soman's argument to be compelling and historically literate. So maybe read them both and decide for yourself.
Nick, you're a neocon now. Is it wise?
Oh, yeah. That's right. I want to point out the reason I'm a neocon is because I think Israel has a right to defend itself.
Wow.
Right. Whew. Full stop. That's why I'm a neocon.
I mean, I work for the Nikki Haley campaign, so just be careful what sentences you say on this podcast, because people will ignore all the sentences you say around them. Full stop.
But to the larger point here, this exemplifies exactly the problem with a neocon-ish, and actually we should just call it a mainstream American foreign policy, is that suddenly you start doing stuff like this, and then the next thing we're embroiled in a major regional conflict that has the potential to go, you know, global. I think it's deeply troubling what Biden is doing, and it's probably exactly what Trump would be doing now, or virtually any other American president, which should be deeply disturbing. And all of the kind of historical and legal niceties aside, the Amash argument about the, you know, about the president having the ability to declare war unilaterally or not needs to be taken more seriously. It needs to be implemented. That, you know, and he argues that the president under the War Powers Act doesn't have the right to just do whatever the fuck he wants and then, you know, a couple months later get in touch with Congress, which they don't even bother doing anymore anyway, which is a problem. But there needs to be much more restraint on kind of first strike capabilities, particularly when we are not talking about something like Pearl Harbor or a direct attack on American, you know, major American interests. It's bad.
I mean, they're shooting at American ships, Nick. We'll swat them away, and they can hijack the.
That
odd
is not
cargo
the full
vessel.
Context of what's going on. We should be defending American property and interests. Legitimately. The good thing about Biden actually is the discussion with Israel. Because Israel at this point is, they need to clarify, but, you know, for themselves, but that's an internal discussion, but for their allies, which include the U.S., legitimately and rightly, what their aims are in Gaza and how do they declare victory and come home. It's very disturbing when people started talking about the October 7th, attacks, terrorist attacks, you know, atrocities committed against Israelis. That was Israel's 9/11. They may be taking the worst lessons from America's response to 9/11, which was to initiate a lot of open-ended conflicts that don't have any clear point of resolution. So good on Biden for kind of forcing issues here. I hope he's doing something similar in Ukraine.
Peter, do you too wish that the Barbary Coast pirates have control of the Red Sea?
I do not wish that.
Yeah. What is the solution to international deadly piracy in this case?
I'll probably figure that out in the next 15 seconds or so.
Okay.
So let's just let me talk until I do.
That sounds.
Oh wait, maybe let's not do that.
That sounds.
No, nobody has a solution here. The whole problem with conflict in the Middle East is that no one has been able to resolve that conflict in a way that is enduring and stable for decades. And I don't think that I'm going to be able to resolve that today on this podcast or even tomorrow. Frankly, if you were like come back in a day with an answer, I don't think I'd have one.
All right, let's go quickly to a lightning round, by which I mean I'm just going to have Peter talk because maybe he has prepared for this answer. Peter, we're in like some kind, it's hard for me to follow what the spending deal is currently that Speaker of the House Mike Johnson is trying to get past the finish line that he sort of negotiated with Chuck Schumer, Democratic Senator. We have immigration on one hand, spending caps on the other. We have restive Freedom Caucus people mad at Mike Johnson, big government things going on, votes this week. What's happening? Give us a brief breakdown.
The very short version is they're going to spend a lot of money. They're going to keep the government open. And the people who want to spend less money, they are going to be mad. And more or less appropriately so, although we would probably disagree with them about border funding and immigration issues. And that's how it's going to go. And so Mike Johnson, the new speaker, came in after the previous speaker, after Kevin McCarthy got ousted for making a bipartisan deal. And what did Mike Johnson do? He is now making a bipartisan deal to spend a whole lot of money. We will see. We will see. I have no idea how this is going to look a week from now, but we will see whether or not this ends up costing Johnson his job as speaker as well. It is not certain, but it is at least a possibility because, like I said, the people who want to spend less money overall and who are more hardcore about spending cuts, they are upset with this deal because it is a bipartisan deal with Democrats. When you make a deal with Democrats, that spends more money than they want to spend. On the other hand, and I will say this for the deal, it's not obvious that there's a way to get a deal to keep the government open and to have and to just sort of move forward with congressional business without making a deal with Democrats that spends more than the Freedom Caucus, smaller government types actually want to spend.
And
so Mike Johnson is in this exact same difficult place that every GOP speaker has found themselves in for the last decade. And his solution is the one that we have seen so many times before, spend a lot more money and then claim victory.
And this, if agreement does get passed, which you are forecasting at this point, and I think seems reasonable, that gets us to when? When is the next time this comes up?
I believe that, so right now they're working on a stopgap spending measure just to get to the point where they vote on the deal as a bunch of different appropriations bills. And so if they can pass a bunch of different appropriations bills in some real sense, then that should get us through at least the end of the fiscal year.
Okay. Which is September. So that's fun in an election year. Okay. Let's go to NDO podcast, what we have all been consuming in the cultural arena. Catherine, why don't you lead us off?
Sure. I don't know if you guys know, but yesterday was Martin Luther King Day. And so my
Reverend Dr.
Martin Luther King Jr. Day. And so I, like a good parent of exactly the number of children that I wanted to have, irrespective of state action, I made my family read some Martin Luther King. I just want to give y'all guys a little quote that was pretty good. This one, like, you see it on the internet, and I'd always seen like the short version floating around, but the longer version is actually pretty good. Don't ever let anyone pull you so low as to hate them. We must use the weapon of love. We must have the compassion and understanding for those who hate us. We must realize that so many people are taught to hate us that they are not totally responsible for their hate. But we stand in life at midnight. We are always on the threshold of a new dawn. I felt like there was just a lot of hate in the air yesterday, vis-a-vis politics and maybe just stuff in general. So some words from Martin Luther King for your consumption this week.
That's lovely. Nick, what did you consume?
Just to comment briefly on that, and Matt, I think you tweeted about this as well. Every Martin Luther King Day, the FBI always makes sure
to
put up a tweet to say, like, oh, you know, we could learn a lot from this guy who we not only ruthlessly and illegally surveilled, but then tried to get him to commit suicide before he accepted the Nobel Peace Prize. As Beverly Gage, the Yale historian, disclosed finally about a little bit more than a decade ago. I watched American Fiction, a new movie starring Jeffrey Wright, which is an incredible film. It's a comedy, and I want to call it a black comedy, both in the sense of its dark humor, and it also is about African Americans. Jeffrey Wright plays an author, a literary author who can't sell books anymore, and he decides to write a fake book from the point of view of a ghetto dweller that is originally called My Pathology, and then it gets renamed Fuck and becomes a big publishing event. It is a fantastic commentary on wokeness, on race relations, and it is not a kind of conservative attack on race relations or anything like that. It is a really deep-seated fundamental critique of the way that we talk about race from a non-white perspective. And I super highly recommend American Fiction. It's funny, it's deep, and it is in theaters now.
Awesome. Peter Suderman, what have you done?
So Catherine's delightful reading included a passage, included a phrase, weapon of love, which is a good transition for my watcha, because I saw the movie The Beekeeper, which is a movie about Jason Statham using weapons, but not out of love. So as you might have gathered from the title of the movie, it's about a guy who keeps bees. And also he kills people. So he lives on a farm at the beginning of the movie, and he's just keeping his bees, making honey. And the woman who owns the farm gets her entire life savings, plus the charity she runs, the children's charity, all the money from the children's charity, stolen by a bunch of young, snotty fishing scammers. So Statham takes it upon himself to kill all of them, because it turns out that he's not just a beekeeper, like a guy who keeps bees. He used to be the beekeeper for the federal government, a sort of unattached CIA super operative, to the point where there's like a whole bit where Jeremy Irons, who plays the former CIA director in this movie, is like talking to tier one special ops guys. And he's like, you all, he uses a word that I won't say, but it starts with P, and it's, you're weaklings. You're like nothing. compared to this guy. And then, of course, Jason Statham kills all of them. And all of this is being run by a young twerp played by Josh Hutcherson of Hunger Games fame. And Hutcherson, it turns out, is the son of the president of the United States. And he's been running this operation to collect campaign money so that she can run a second campaign. It's totally ridiculous, but it's actually a kind of great populist action movie about how like business, foreign policy and government elites are all just screwing you and living these like absolutely ridiculous, lavish lives of luxury and pleasure. And they don't care about you at all. And what you need is a guy like Jason Statham to come in and put things right by killing people. Sadly, he doesn't kill people with bees very much. He throws a jar of honey at somebody at one point, but there's not a lot of actually bee-related killing, but there are a lot of bee puns, which I really loved, and Jason Statham murdering people with like keyboards and elevators and a truck. It's a pretty good movie. Beekeeper.
Would just like to point out that Peter's apparent troubles of pronouncing Jason Statham's last name, which I absolutely share, is a reason for me not to watch his movies or by Michael Strahan. What's the guy's name? He's a really great actor.
Michael Strahan?
Strahan? Yeah, come on. It rhymes with Reihan. No, just not going to do that. Cultural consumption is the favorite documentary I've watched in a good long time, or the second favorite actually, since I really liked the American Buffalo by Ken Burns. But it's called Made You Look, A True Story About Fake Art. Came out in 2020. Director is Barry Average, who I didn't know. Average, okay, not average. and it's a story about incredible. Like a multi-year, almost two decades, I think, basically peddling of hoax modern art from New York, fake Jackson Pollocks, fake Rothkos, and whatever, and $80 million worth of fake art from this gallery that ended up being closed. It was open for 150 years, like August Gallery, owned weirdly by the Arm & Hammer family. It is such a delightful movie, partly because it gets nearly everybody involved, especially the woman who is making the decisions at the gallery, on camera, trying to kind of grapple with whether it's her intention or not. It's probably not. But like you as a viewer, like how do you delude yourself into believing something that is totally not on the up and up? Is, and like, what is the process of that self-delusion? When do you become a party to it? When do you not? It's just really fascinating. They have the prosecutor.
Is there any like political relevance to this, would you say?
You know,
a contemporary like stuff in the news.
I don't think in metaphors. I think only in abstract art and expressionism.
You think in mixed metaphors.
Yeah,
man.
That's true. I went to the National Gallery this weekend and saw the Rothko exhibit, which is like his work on paper. And I don't know why you would need to bother to fake a Rothko, because that dude was faking his own work. Like, he was so prolific at the end of his life, like 430 pieces in a year, and it shows. Like, I don't know. It just feels like you can't.
I mean, there's
play a
there's
player.
There's an element of that, and they don't play it too hard, but that you would take out of it. I know certainly Nick would, of like, it calls into question what makes value in art. And at some point, the lawyer for the woman who sold all of these pieces, as he's talking, he's got, I don't think it's a Rothko, but I think a Jackson Pollock behind him. And he's like, you know, a couple of years ago, this was worth $3 million, and now it's worth nothing and it's hanging in my office. And isn't that weird? Like, how and why do we value these things? And it's really fascinating. And all of the characters are such ridiculous, like New York characters or European Italian fancy people characters. They're all hilarious, mostly unintentionally, but like, just it's terrific. Good fun. Made You Look, A True Story About Fake Art by Barry Average. You can get it on Netflix and similar
one thing
places.
That is fascinating, Matt Welch, is that documentaries about fake art now outnumber documentaries about real art by like 10 to 1 or more.
There's apparently a second documentary about this that came out the year before, which I haven't seen. Be hard pressed to believe that it'd be better than this. And again, points to a thing that we've talked about a lot on this podcast, which is that like documentaries that don't have executive producer buyout from one of the characters, they could be better journalistically, turns out. Although some of the Last Dance was still great. That's all of the time that we have for this particular dance. Nice to be back with everyone again. Mm-hmm. Go to all of our podcasts at reason.com/podcasts. We also have a bunch of events in New York. And Nick, do you have any that you would care to point people towards?
Yes, very much so. Next Monday, January 22nd, we're hosting a live Reason interview taping with David Stockman, the maverick budget director under Ronald Reagan, who wrote a book called The Triumph of Politics in the 80s, which is still one of the great DC memoirs. It's subtitled Why the Reagan Revolution Went Wrong, or Why the Reagan Revolution Failed. And his new book is Trump's War on Capitalism. So it is, David Stockman is a difficult to kind of pigeonhole super capitalist who also hates the warfare state as much as he hates the welfare state. And he talks about it in those old kind of new left terms still. But David Stockman, we'll be talking to him on January 22nd. Go to reason.com/events to buy tickets. $10 gets you beer, wine, food, and love, actually.
That's right.
Love. And love.
All right. We will catch you next week. Thank you. Goodbye.